You know, the internet can be a fantastic source of information if you're looking in the right places.
Right.
It can also be a terrible source of information, and one, and not necessarily because people are trying to mislead others, although that does happen. But science changes. Like, science is not something that just stays the same forever.
Are you raising a family while also feeling like you're still growing up yourself? Do you wonder if you are getting it right? Welcome to Growing Up with Dr. Sarah. She's a pediatrician and a mom, and she helps the whole family.
Hi, I'm Dr. Sarah Adams, a board-certified pediatrician, but I'm not your pediatrician. Feel free to use my podcast as helpful information, but in no way do I intend my podcast to replace the advice of your physician. Your physician knows you and is in the best position to provide medical advice. Hello, and welcome back to Growing Up with Dr. Sarah. I have a very special guest today. His name is Dr. Mike Patrick from Pediacast. Dr. Mike, I'm so glad to have you here. You've been doing your own podcast called Pediacast for nearly 2 decades, which is incredible. And you've really built something that families and providers trust. I also know that you wear many hats, emergency medicine, education, podcasting, and you've been in this space since 2006. I also learned that you used to be a DJ before you went to medical school, which I think is super cool. But long before podcasting came, you started what it is today. What made you say, this is the way I want to reach families?
Yeah, that's a loaded question. So first, let me say it's great being here with you, Sarah.
Thank you.
And I'm excited to talk about pediatrics today and how we get great information out for families. But for me, it really started when I was in private practice in kind of an underserved area. So it was a group practice, but we were incredibly busy because there really weren't a lot of other options for families in the area where I was practicing. And so we had to see lots and lots of kids, and the visits, you know, when you have a waiting room full of patients, you feel this pressure to sort of move people through because no one likes to sit in the waiting room for a long period of time. But we also didn't want to turn people away. You know, we wanted to see as many people as we could. And so I really was not satisfied with the amount of time that I had per patient. But I also knew a lot of the things that I told families was the same. Like, you know, why does my kid keep getting ear infections? Or how can I prevent them from getting another virus? And so you have these scripts, right, that you're used to telling folks. And I just felt like there should be some kind of vehicle where I could say, here's the quick answer. But if you want a little more of the science behind why that's the answer, you know, more instead of the 3-minute explanation, you know, what is the 15 or 20 minute explanation? And so I started actually writing a blog. That's kind of how I got started. But then podcasts were coming out. It was right around 2005 into 2006. And so I started to listen to podcasts about how to make podcasts. And because I had experience as a DJ way back when, at a couple of radio stations and at a skating rink, it really kind of struck that this is a great way to reach families. So I launched it in 2006, and I was fortunate that Apple, there weren't a lot of podcasts out.
No.
And so Apple highlighted it on the front page of their kids and family section in iTunes. And so I was able to get a pretty big audience. You know, I was just expecting it to be my own patients. And I would have been fine with that in the beginning. But Apple highlighted it, and, you know, we got thousands of listeners pretty much right out of the gate. And so that's how it got started.
You and I have a similar way that we started, in that I also worked in a very rural area where there were no specialists or pediatric emergency medicine. So I can totally relate with that. And also the time factor. I remember for myself, I was driving to work and I was just trying to think of a way that I could educate, inform outside of the office. So we have very similar whys, and I really appreciate you sharing that with me because it does make a difference. Sometimes there's only so much time, and I really want to focus when I'm in the office setting, and I'm sure the same when you're doing urgent care or ER or even primary care. We need to focus on what their needs are. And then we also have a checklist of things we want to get done. So there isn't a lot of time sometimes to talk about some topics that are really important. So one of the biggest stress points I know for parents is not knowing when something is serious. So let's start with the question that every parent has. How do we know when to call the pediatrician versus go to the urgent care versus heading to the ER?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And I think it really comes down to a mom's, I always call it like spidey sense. You know what I mean? Like you just have this feeling and you should pay attention to those. So we'd rather you kind of overcall it and go to an emergency room when you didn't necessarily have to. It's inconvenient for sure. But you don't want to be in the situation where you should have gone to the emergency room and you didn't. So the first thing I would say is just if that spidey sense, parent spidey sense is going off, pay attention to it and get the help that you think that you need. Now, if you are going back and forth, I always say give your doctor a call. And so someone is always available, right? There's someone on call. It might be an answering service. That's fine. If it's something that you think could wait till morning, absolutely wait until morning. You know, if they're a little uncomfortable, they have a fever, you can give them Motrin or Tylenol. But I think most parents have a sense that maybe this can't wait until morning. And so in that situation, I would just give your doctor a call and explain the situation, and then they can guide you on, no, this is something that can wait till morning. No, I think you ought to go to an urgent care. No, go ahead and go to an emergency room that takes care of kids or call 911. Like those are all valid options depending on what the situation is. And if you are struggling, that's what your pediatrician is there for. That's why there is someone on call. Now, your doctor doesn't want, you know, they have a family too. And even though they're on call, like you don't want to bother them if your kids had a runny nose for a couple of hours, you know? But I think most parents get the sense that, no, this is, I'm concerned enough that I should call someone, and then that's what you should do.
I really appreciate that message because I tell parents all the time, there's always someone that you can talk to, whether it's during the day, office hours. Of course, my chart, if it's not urgent, I always tell people, do not leave an urgent message because those, you know, we kind of try to answer them within 24 hours. And at least for our institution, my chart is pretty much business hours open. So because we have the nurses that review it before it actually gets to the provider. But I want to stress that message about calling, because so many, I agree, we don't want to call, you know, for, oh, I've got a bug bite or something. You know, I don't mean to belittle bug bites because they can get pretty bad too. But what I'm trying to say is that it's okay. It's okay. If you're thinking, should I call? You probably should call and just find out what is the best. And I love the spidey sense because I think that I always say people know their kids better than even we do. And so using those senses is so important. Now you mentioned 911. What is truly a call 911 moment opposed to calling your pediatrician? What should parents never second guess?
Yeah. Difficulty breathing for sure. You know, getting oxygen in the body is very important. So yes. If they're having an asthma attack or, you know, you don't really know why all of a sudden they're not breathing very well. But if you're concerned about your child's breathing, that is just get help right away. Another would be if a kiddo has a severe allergic reaction. So an example would be they're covered in hives and maybe they're vomiting or they seem like they're having trouble breathing or they're wheezing along with it, you know, especially when there's, you know, more than one body system involved. If you have an EpiPen, just do it. There's so many families that are afraid to use it. It's not going to hurt anything. It might make your child feel a little anxious as a side effect. But it's a safe medicine to use and can be life-saving for sure. And then once you've used that EpiPen, still call 911, get to the hospital as soon as you can, let someone look you over, watch you for a while. And if you don't have an EpiPen, then definitely call 911 if you think they're having a sudden allergic reaction to something. So that would be another reason. Any bleeding that doesn't want to stop, it's going to be important, you know, apply pressure. But then someone should be calling 911 for that as well. I think those are the biggest ones. And then the other, you know, like if a kid falls out of a tree and they're just laying and don't want to move, or if there are severe burns over a large part of their body, again, that's where that spidey sense does come in. Like, this is a bigger deal than, you know, what is normal. And so just get help right away in any of those kind of significant situations.
If you're liking this conversation with Dr. Mike from Pediacast, please like, subscribe, and share. And stay with us. We're bringing you more crucial information you can use every single day. Those are all really important things that, like I said, parents should never second guess. And just to add to that, the EMS will come and evaluate your child, right? And they will decide if they need to go by ambulance, or sometimes they'll say, I think that this is okay, if you're okay, to take you by car. So if those spidey sentences, I think that's going to be a recurring theme here. You feel you should call, and all those things are so important. Yeah. I want to talk, if we could, about head injuries, because you mentioned falling out of a tree, and we know kids like fall out of trees, get injured in sports, fall out of bunk beds. I'm trying to think of all the different things. And no matter what age, what are the signs that matter most when it comes to head injuries?
Yeah, another really great question. And this one, there's really good evidence behind what we consider symptoms of a severe head injury. And that evidence comes from an organization called PCARN. And what PCARN is the Pediatric Emergency Care Applied Research Network. And it is a conglomeration of children's hospitals, emergency departments that can pool their patient populations. So because, you know, in pediatrics, we don't see as many kids as many patients as in adult medicine, because there aren't as many kids as there are adults. Mm-hmm. And so by pooling patient groups, we can get much larger numbers to study. So what PCARN did is they looked at all the kids who had serious head injuries. So they started with that and then said, okay, well, what symptoms did they present with? And then they did have a significant head injury versus maybe what symptoms were present that did not relate to a serious head injury. So they were able to collect like what to watch for. And then they did what's called a prospective study, where they now did a much larger study of kids who were presenting. And then, you know, some of them would get CAT scans, some of them would not, to try to see if those same symptoms predicted who had a serious injury and who did not. So what are those symptoms?
I think all of your points that you made are so helpful, especially the main points about prolonged loss of consciousness, severe headache, frequent vomiting, irritability, if they're too young to explain how their headache is, all such important points. And talking about the CAT scan, you taught me something. I actually did not realize that in an adult ER, their CAT scans use more radiation. So appreciate you sharing that. Such great information, because you and I know that's one of a very common thing that parents ask about, is whether or not they need a CAT scan. And we're getting into time of year, which kids are going to be playing outside, doing all kinds of fun things, of course, sports. And so let's shift a little bit and talk about seasons and everyday risks. I love how your podcasts, you talk about what's actually happening right now, because parenting doesn't happen in a vacuum. Depending on the time of year, what are the biggest risks families should be thinking about? Like, the big issues in spring are allergies, and winter we've got RSV, flu, other seasonal colds. Pick a season, Mike, and let's start from there.
Yeah. Well, we're in springtime right now. And, you know, we're starting to see tick bites come in. Mm-hmm. And that's one of those things that there's a lot of press about Lyme disease and tick bites. It used to be when I started training that the deer tick or the black-legged tick, they're these really tiny little ticks, like the size of a sesame seed. And when they get bloated, they're no bigger than the end of a number two eraser. So they're very small ticks. And they really were a lot of them in Ohio back when I trained and early in my medical career. And so you used to be able to say, hey, if your kid has a tick bite, you know, and it's a large tick, you know, when it's attached and filled with blood, it may be, you know, this, not quite a penny, but maybe like a button size, definitely larger than the end of a number two pencil eraser. But if it's a big tick, it's most likely a dog tick or, you know, a wood tick, and it's something that's not going to give you Lyme disease. Whereas the black-legged tick or the deer tick, those little tiny ones, can. And so a lot of kids now do get these black-legged ticks in Ohio because with climate change, the ticks are moving west and into our habitat. And so we are seeing a lot more of those. And so a lot of folks do come into the emergency room with ticks attached or with a recent tick bite or with a rash around where a tick had bitten. And the other thing that a lot of parents don't realize is the tick has to be attached 24, but probably closer to 48 hours in order to transmit the organism that causes Lyme disease. So even if you get bit, but you find it right away, and remove it successfully, it's very unlikely that your child's going to get Lyme disease. However, they're so small and, you know, they can crawl under the clothes, be up in an armpit. I just saw one of those the other day. And when you do go in, make sure you take that tick with you if you can, if you have removed it, because your doctor will be able to look at it and tell if it's a deer tick or if it's a bigger tick. So that can be one helpful thing. But, you know, it's something that we actually see starting this time of year quite a bit in the emergency department. And, you know, do you have to go see someone in the ER? No, you can remove it yourself. And if you live in a wooded area or with tall grasses, or, you know, you're a little more likely that your kids are going to get a tick. In that case, you may want to have a tick removal tool, which is just this really flat, thin little piece of metal. It's kind of V-shaped, and you just put it in between the tick and the skin. And then you just pull up with a gentle, steady pressure until the tick releases. You don't want to do it too hard or firm, because then you may tear the tick apart and leave the head in the skin and just have the tick's body. We see that a lot, actually.
Yes.
And if you don't have the special tool, you can use like a credit card to try to get under the tick. But the tool actually is V-shaped, and it really gets under there much easier than a credit card does. So I suspect tick bites is not what folks were expecting me to say, but we do see a lot, and they do cause parents a lot of concern.
Cause a lot of anxiety, and especially with, you know, like you said, there used to be just certain regions where that specific deer tick was more prevalent, and now we're seeing it more in Ohio and even other states. So I think it's so important that you bring it up, because I know it when those are a lot of the phone calls that I get about ticks. Summer as well, water safety is something that I get really nervous about. And so I'd love to hear for our listeners some of your tips about water safety, sun exposure, and so on, because we know there's a lot we can prevent.
Yeah, absolutely. The biggest thing with water safety, like if I had to boil it down to one rule, it's going to be have adult supervision when your child's in the water, and even if there's lifeguards present. So if you go to a public pool and you're there with a group of friends, someone should have their eyes on the kids in the water at all times. Mm-hmm. And that way, if they go under and don't come back up, because we know drowning is silent, there's usually not a ton of splashing and noise. They just slip under the water. And so unless you're constantly watching, you can miss that. And then you can yell for the lifeguard, because you're going to be watching one little group of kids. They're trying to keep their eye on the entire pool. And so it's going to be really important just to watch your kids, even if they're a strong swimmer. You know, the strongest of swimmers can get hit in the head with an elbow,
right,
and get a little dizzy and go underwater and get confused of which direction's up. And they may be a very excellent swimmer and still have an issue. So that supervision, I think, is really important. And it is good, I think, to go to pools with a group, because it is hard for one person just to be watching the water all the time. Right. But if you have an assigned person, then the rest of the group can chat. You can read a book. You listen to music, you know, relax. If you go to the pool by yourself and your kids are in the pool, that's a little more work. But I'm telling you, if it's my family and my kids, which, you know, our kids are our greatest treasure, I really do want your eyes on them. You know, then there's all the other things, like if you have a home pool, making sure that there's a fence all the way around so neighbor kids don't get into it. You want a self-latching gate. It's preferable not to have an indoor door that goes out onto the pool deck. You know, you really want a fence between the house and the water, mm-hmm, if you can. You know, the alarms. You know, alarms are helpful if you listen to them and pay attention to them, but a lot of times they go off, you know, because the wind blew the sensor or something, and then right, you start to get alarm fatigue and you may not pay attention to it, or it might not work. So I wouldn't rely on those. They're good to have, you know, if you have no other choice, but the best is going to be a fence that's completely surrounds your pool with a self-latching gate. And then to remember that even shallow bodies of water, even baby pools, you know, you may have a toddler and the water only goes up, you know, halfway up to their knee. But if they slip and fall and bang their head and their face is underwater, they, you know, we see kids drown in those kind of situations. So I think, you know, parental supervision is the biggest thing for me.
I would agree. And I want to restate what you said about they don't always splash around and make a lot of noise. It's very often that they're silently drowning. And so I think that's important to restate.
Another thing that comes up a lot is this delayed drowning, or sometimes it's called dry drowning.
Right, right, yes.
What that is, it's just symptoms that begin after, you know, like with time. So they didn't slip underwater and now they're having symptoms like difficulty breathing, coughing, you know, feeling chest pain, that sort of thing. They seem to be okay, and then there's a problem. We hear about those a lot in the news, but they're actually very, very rare. And so most of the time, it's going to be symptoms right away if there's something significant going on. You know, the number of cases where symptoms, they had no symptoms, and then symptoms start like a day later is just incredibly rare. So a lot of times, you know, if you think back, well, you know, they did have this persistent cough and then it got worse. So if they do have a water event with symptoms that sort of linger, I would have them checked out. But, you know, once they're checked out, if they look good, sound good, maybe they get a chest x-ray that's normal, you don't have to worry about that anymore. You know, it's unlikely that very unlikely that your child's going to have an issue 2 days later.
That's really important to point out, because that is something, although extremely rare, does cause a lot of anxiety, like you mentioned. So definitely worth mentioning. I appreciate that. Now let's go towards fall and winter. We know there's colds, there's flu, RSV, COVID, all of those illnesses that are more common in colder weather. You mentioned ticks as something that people wouldn't think of. What's your number one concern in the wintertime outside of those classic sicknesses?
Yeah, well, we do see injuries in the winter, and where I live, there's some skiing places, but Ohio is not well known for its great skiing conditions or people who necessarily know how to ski very well. And so we do see a lot of ski snowboard injuries that happen. We have ice and a lot of people on the slope who don't really know what they're doing. So that is not a good combination in terms of injuries occurring. You know, sledding, we see sledding injuries as well. You really want to be careful where you're sledding. Make sure there aren't any obstacles, no trees, no roads at the bottom, or parking lots are all going to be really important. Single riders are going to be safer than two or three, because you can bonk heads. You can, you know, get ankles and arms wrapped around each other and get broken bones that way. So, yeah, and you don't want to necessarily have two sledders too close together where they could collide. So you just want to be smart about it. you know, one rider per sled, go down one at a time, make sure there's no obstacles. And so you do want to know what your kids are doing and where they're doing it.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you have to hover. If you have a kid who, you know, you trust and they're used to running around the neighborhood with friends and there is a sledding hill, just know, you know, where they're sledding, make sure it's safe, make sure they know the rules, and make sure that they have a way to contact you, you know, a smartphone, if there's any kind of problem that they can get in touch with you right away. But those sledding injuries, you know, we do see some pretty serious ones.
And I love how you talked about obstacles, because I remember as a kid, one time I was sledding and I went so far out, I didn't even realize I could do that. And I went right into a creek. So, I mean, there's also drowning. We don't think about that,
yeah.
But and a lot of times we don't think about what are the obstacles. But I remember as a child literally running into the creek, and thankfully I was just wet and cold, but it is something to be mindful of. And I'm going to also restate just having a way to contact your parents, which is so smart, so smart. So let's move on from our seasonal conversation. One thing we talked about when you and I first connected is just how much misinformation is out there and how confusing it can be for families. From your perspective, why is it so hard for parents to know what to trust right now?
Yeah, that is such an important question for folks to consider. You know, the internet can be a fantastic source of information if you're looking in the right places.
Right.
It can also be a terrible source of information, and not necessarily because people are trying to mislead others, although that does happen. But science changes. Like, science is not something that just stays the same forever. We have new studies, we have, you know, data that then confirms studies or maybe lets you know that, nah, that's not the greatest study. And that's why things change over time. And just as an example of that, if you remember during the pandemic, I think we all have PTSD from pandemic days.
Definitely.
But, you know, at first they were saying, no, you don't need masks. And then you do need masks. And then, well, maybe you don't need masks. And you know, as we got more data, recommendations changed. But the old recommendations are still going to be on the internet, because we don't often go back and like get rid of things. It's cumulative. And so if you come across something that shows science, that still might not be right anymore. And so you really do want to make sure that you're looking at the latest up-to-date kind of information. So you want a reputable source. And so then you also want a source that can look at guidelines and say, this is good science or this is not great science. So anyone can say anything and back it up, but that doesn't mean that what they're using to back it up is good science. And I think that those of us who went to medical school, maybe got a PhD along with our MD, like, we have a sense of what makes a good study and what makes a study that could maybe give you information that's not cause and effect, that just they're related, but it doesn't mean that one thing caused another.
Right.
And an example with that is thimerosal or mercury that was in vaccines as a preservative. You know, suddenly it was, this is bad, even though the total amount of mercury that a kiddo would be exposed to during all of the childhood immunizations. Now, this is back in the like late 90s, early 2000s, when this was coming out. So there weren't as many vaccines back then. And the total amount that a kiddo would get exposed to mercury-wise from birth through kindergarten, all those vaccines, it was less mercury than in one can of tuna fish.
Wow. But I never realized that.
We would say, oh, there's mercury. This is a bad thing. So they took mercury out of the immunizations because of this data and because of, well, we don't want mercury in there. Well, the problem with that was then those multi-dose vials is how most of the vaccines came. And the mercury, there was just a drop of it in there, so that when you opened it and you took out a dose and then it sat on the shelf until the next kiddo needed it, that it wouldn't get contaminated. That was the reason that it was there. So now we had to switch to completely single serve vaccines. And that creates more packaging, more plastics, more paper, more expense. and they couldn't keep up with demand. So suddenly, when they took all the thimerosal out, we had shortages of vaccines. And so kids weren't able to get all the things that they needed. And that was on us. And we kind of confirmed to people that mercury was a problem. Like, we need to get this out of the vaccines, when it really probably wasn't a problem at all. And then today, you know, we see the same old stories, the same, oh, we've got, this is bad. Vaccines are doing this or that. And you can, you know, if you subscribe to vaccines causing issues, you're going to find evidence, because there's going to be bad science out there that will kind of show what you want it to show, but it doesn't mean that it's really A is causing B, if that makes sense.
Yes. And I think it's so important that you mention, a lot of times, you know, what information is out there. When we think about the digital space, when I talk about safety in regards to kids and being online, which is a whole nother subject, but I tell them that once information is out there, it's pretty much out there. It's very hard to remove. So I could see how medical information stays out there. And I really want to thank you for explaining medical information and the need to have a reputable source that can actually land with families. So important, because the reality of family life is that, you know, it's getting confusing. I know if I'm confused, I kind of feel like they're confused too, right? You know, and so it's important to ask questions. I always tell families, please, you know, don't be afraid to ask me. I want to hear what your concerns are about vaccines or masks or ticks or all the different things that that we've talked about so far. And yeah. I really appreciate how what really stood out for me in everything that you've said so far, and what you mentioned on your podcast, is you're meeting families where they are. How do you think pediatric advice needs to adapt to real world constraints? Because you're an educator as well, and we've all got the busy schedules. You mentioned limited resources, there's stress on families, there's stress on our clinics, right? So if you're talking to a medical student or resident, and even the families that are listening, how do you think that this advice needs to be adapted to real world?
Yeah. You know, I think that empathy is going to play a really big part in all of this. That, like, if you have vaccine hesitant parents, and, you know, they've come across information online that has them concerned about vaccines, I think just understanding why they're concerned is going to be so important. They care about their kids. They don't want vaccines to harm their children. And we also care about their kids. We don't want vaccines to harm their children. We want vaccines to protect them. And so I think, first, not vilifying parents who are vaccine hesitant, but understanding where they're coming from, and maybe asking those questions of what are you reading? Why are you concerned? Will you let me share some resources with you that may tell a different story? And sometimes it takes offering that several times before someone is like, you know, maybe I should listen to my doctor. And so I think just being patient with people. I know practices that will not see kids of vaccine hesitant parents. Like, if you are not pro-vaccine, you cannot come here. I don't particularly like that.
We
just need to understand where people are coming from, understand why it is that they're concerned. There are bad players out there, but most parents care about their kids, and that's where they're coming from. And that's where we're coming from. And so I think just, you know, if I'm talking to medical students or residents and, you know, like, oh, this parent's refusing all their vaccines, like, well, let's take a step back and try to figure out why that is. And that takes time. See, that becomes part of the issue. You and I both know that, you know, there are enough pediatric providers out there. Everyone's busy. The waiting room's full. No one likes to wait. And so how do you, how do you balance that? I need to get through all my patients for the day, but I also need to explain things in a way that can make a difference in health outcomes. And so I think that's one of the reasons you and I both do what we do, because we can reach so many people through digital media and hopefully make a difference in families who we never actually see in person.
I couldn't agree more. You've reached millions of listeners and built a broad audience. And that's a lot of responsibility, having so many parents trust you. What have you learned about what parents actually need from you, not just as a doctor, but as a voice that they can trust?
Yeah, I think that they need someone to listen, you know, to what their concerns are. It's so easy just to, you know, even a lot of times I'll kind of know what's going on with the kid before I even walk in the room. I mean, just looking at the nurse's note, what the chief complaint is, what time of year it is, what are the things that we're seeing right now. Right. And so I may go in already thinking, oh, this kid's got the flu. Even if their flu test is negative, I think they have the flu, because those flu tests are not 100% accurate.
Right. We look at the child, right? Not always the test.
Yeah. And so we kind of know what's going on. And it's so easy to say to a parent, like, okay, this is what's happening. This is what we need to do. Goodbye. But unless you kind of take the time to figure out what it is they're concerned about, then you're not going to address their particular need. And they're going to leave with, oh, he just said it was a virus. He didn't listen to me. He didn't care. He's just busy. I'm going to go see someone else until I get the answer that I want.
Right.
And so I'm using a virus, but they're just, I mean, there are countless examples of when you just take the time to find out what is it that a parent's worried about. Then you can address their specific fear much more efficiently than if you just go in, this is what it is, this is what you need to do, see you later.
I couldn't agree more. I really try my best as a provider, and also educating those that are our future providers, that many times what we think is their priority is actually something completely different. And so just asking them things like, out of the three things you mentioned, what concerns you the most? And a lot of times I find that that helps with efficiency. You know, they're busy too. And so they don't want to spend, you know, an hour or more in the doctor's office as well. So two things I heard you say that I really want to emphasize, and that is showing empathy and listening. And people listening might think, especially those, like I said, our future doctors, you might be thinking to yourself, oh my gosh, I don't have time for that. But in all actuality, I don't know about you, Dr. Mike, but I've learned when I do that, when I listen and when I show empathy, it actually saves me time. And they did a study in JAMA actually that showed that with internal medicine providers as well as surgeons. So I think it's really worth mentioning. And this has been such a fantastic conversation. You've provided so many insights and resources. I always like to end with a few takeaways parents can hold on to. So we're trying to brand it as our quick hits segment now. So here we go. One piece of advice for staying calm in a medical moment. We talked about 911 issues. Maybe they got to the ER or the urgent care, and like you mentioned, it was much more serious. What's one piece of advice for staying calm in a medical moment?
You know, I think it is trusting the people who are caring for your child. And hopefully your doctor is someone that you trust. The local urgent care, maybe you find one that is pediatric specific, or you go to an emergency department at a children's hospital. And as long as the provider is listening to what it is that you have to say, and you feel like you're able to explain what your concerns are, and then they give you their take, I would trust that. Now, there are situations where, you know, your spidey sense is like, no. And, you know, we hear all the time, I saw three different doctors before someone finally listened to me. Mm-hmm. And I get that. But that's the exception. And most of the time, if you have a competent pediatric provider trusting their advice and ask questions, you know, try to understand, well, why are we managing it like this? Why is this the treatment? Why is that going to work? What are we going to do if that doesn't work? That, you know, that's something that we see a lot in medical moments, because the treatment that was prescribed isn't working. And so then, just as humans, it's kind of human nature to think, well, maybe that doctor didn't know what they were doing, or they had the wrong diagnosis. And yet the doctor had a plan in their head of if this doesn't work, this is the next thing we're going to try. But parents and doctors don't necessarily connect on that, right? And so I think just that communication and trusting is going to be really important. Sure, you're going to have anxiety. All parents, you know, because you love your kids and you don't want something to be missed. So you're going to have that like, well, what if this isn't the right diagnosis? But I think that we just need to practice trusting each other and knowing that the physician also has your child's best interest in mind. And they may seem like they're in a hurry because there is that stress of the whole waiting room, but they also want to do a good job. They want to take care of your kiddo. And so I think, you know, putting the stress on someone else's shoulders but that requires a parent to trust the provider that they're seeing. And that's why it's so important to, you know, pick someone that you communicate well with. You know, we all have different personalities, different temperaments. I mean, that's what makes the world so wonderful, that there's so many different kinds of people. And so the way that I practice medicine may not be ideal for a particular parent personality. So, you know, it's okay to find someone that you mesh with, that you really feel like you can trust. And I think that takes some of the pressure off.
Trust and continuity of care is so important. I remember when I first started practicing, I was working with another physician that I did my residency with. And it was so funny because she could see way more patients than I could in a day. And she was a lot quicker than I am. And she used to tease me and call me the handholder. But what happened in our practice was those that really just wanted to get in and out saw her. And those that needed a little handholding, they saw me. So I think it's such great advice to tell people, find someone that you trust. And I realize too, that you may not be able to see them every time, you know, you need to bring your child in. And I think it's important that you ask, like, can this wait a couple of days so that I can see my provider, versus no, you really need to see who's available today. And so again, it goes back to that first question, that first segment we were talking about, is when is it something that's urgent, and don't be afraid to call. What's one health concern parents tend to overreact to, and how can we ease their worries a little bit?
You know, one I would say is how many viruses or colds that kids get in a year.
Oh, good one. You know, that's a good one.
My kids always sick. And what we have to realize is the way that our immune system works is that we have to get sick with every virus that's out there in order to make immunity. Now, little babies, when they're born, have some of mom's immunity, so that's great, but then that wears off. And so by the time that they're 4 to 6 months old, they now need to start catching everything and making immunity. So when a kid goes to daycare and they're sick all the time, it's their body doing what it's supposed to do. And I always tell parents, you know, that if they're getting sick all the time in daycare, when they go to kindergarten, they're probably going to be pretty darn healthy. And it's the kids who don't go to daycare, which is fine. But when they go to kindergarten, they're going to be sick all the time, because that's just the way our body works. And each child ends up with an average of about 10 viral infections every year. So that's about one a month, except that they're squished into the winter time. So like late fall into early spring.
Right. So it seems like a lot.
Illnesses, and each of them lasts, you know, 1 to 2 weeks. You can easily get overlapping ones. Next thing you know, your kid's been sick for almost a month just with two viruses, and they're going to get 10. So, you know, we do see a lot of kids who just seem like they're sick all the time. And that's just the way that our immune system works. And so I think just providing that reassurance and explaining to people, if I had a dollar for every parent that told me their kid is sick all the time and who's worried about that, I wouldn't have to practice medicine anymore.
I know I'm chuckling, and it's not funny. You know, I want to share with those that are watching and listening. It's certainly not funny that your child is getting, you know, having those frequent colds or viruses or illnesses, like you mentioned. I think I'm chuckling because it is so true. And I know that I worried about it as a parent. I had one kid who never got sick, and the other kid, he got everything when the wind was blowing, he got it, you know? I really appreciate you easing people's worry about that and explaining it in a way that they can understand.
Yeah. You know, another thing is siblings.
Yes.
It'll be much worse, because if you think about the viral load, the first kid that gets sick in your house was maybe they just were exposed to it at the grocery store in passing. So they're going to have a very mild illness because there just wasn't a lot of viral load to begin with. But the sibling who is now sharing a bedroom with that sick kid, they're going to get a lot of the virus.
Yes.
And so oftentimes that second one is a lot sicker. Aww. And then parents are concerned like, well, Billy had it and he wasn't this sick. And it's because you had a lot more exposure in that second kid than the first one. So sometimes just explaining that, because it's not something that parents think about. They think, oh, there's something wrong with this other kid because they were so sick with it. Whereas the first child got over it really easily. But that can be explained with science.
Yes, again. Thank you so much, Dr. Mike. We're so grateful you came on our show. Listeners, I really want you to check out Dr. Mike's podcast, PediaCast, for incredible advice, more thoughtful conversations. Actually, we'll be on an episode together later this year.
Yes, and in a couple weeks, I think.
That's right. So that's right. I'm looking forward to it.
We're going to talk about mealtime, sleep, there's another thing we're talking about that's important.
I think it's screen time. We're going to how all of that can interact with each other, right?
Yeah. Screen time, sleep, mealtime. And especially when you think about toddlers, those can be difficult times. So we're going to have a great time talking about it. This is the problem. You and I could go on for hours.
Right? I know. I really appreciate you being on the show. And thank you to everyone that is listening. Such great advice. We talked about some things that we know are very important and can cause a lot of thought and anxiety. But just listening and showing empathy, I want to remind everybody, can go a long way. So thanks again, Dr. Mike, and let's grow up together.
Produced by Autovita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.